On Tuesday, December 31st, protesters broke into the United States Embassy in Baghdad, setting fires and breaking windows. The protests were in response to a United States airstrike in Iraq over the weekend, which killed at least 24 members of an Iranian-backed militia. The airstrike drew outrage across Iraq and condemnation of U.S. intervention in the country. And although the demonstrators dispersed on Wednesday, these protests are just the latest sign of growing unrest in Iraq in recent months. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke about the Iraq protests Tuesday on Fox News.
Well, what you saw was Iranian-backed terrorists. Many of them are individuals that have been designated terrorists by the United States and others, coming to the American embassy and posing a risk to American diplomats and personnel inside the embassy. You saw President Trump direct a quick, decisive, prudent response by making sure that we had all the resources necessary to keep our people safe and to secure the compound as well.
And just how to handle the unrest in Iraq is just one of the many significant foreign policy issues that President Trump will be facing in the new year. The United States' relationship with countries ranging from North Korea to Russia to Great Britain will all be subject to intense scrutiny in the coming months. Joining me now is Robin Wright. She's a distinguished fellow at the Wilson Center and a contributor to The New Yorker. Robin, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
We'll start with the attack on the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. I mean, what led to these protests?
There have been protests in Iraq generally. This has been an increasingly unstable environment. And in that context, the U.S. struck at a pro-Iranian militia that had been attacking the United States interests, and very specifically a U.S. base near Kirkuk, where one contractor and two Iraqi policemen were killed. The death of an American led for the first time to a response that targeted the militia, but implicitly also targeted Iran. This comes after months of tension separately with Iran over the striking of a oil facility in Saudi Arabia, the shooting down of an American drone over the Persian Gulf, and the attacks on tankers. So this has been a combustible environment that suddenly exploded.
Let's talk about President Trump's response to the attacks. He's alleging that this attack on the U.S. embassy was ordered from Tehran, and in a tweet, the president said, quote, "This is not a warning. It is a threat." Robin, a threat of what?
Well, that's one of the big questions. What does the United States do? I think the bigger question for the United States is whether, after 17 years of war, more than $1 trillion in American treasure and more than 4,000 American lives, whether the United States is kind of losing Iraq. The demonstrators pull back from the embassy on the condition that Parliament would debate a resolution to demand that the U.S. troops withdraw from Iraq at a time that there is still an ISIS presence off in the western part of the country, carrying out attacks, waging an insurgency. So there's a lot going on, and this tension plays out in all of these flashpoints.
What have the troop levels been in Iraq, American troop levels been? Because one of the arguments against withdrawing troops and U.S. military support overall in Iraq is that it would allow for Iran to exert even more influence in the country. Is that what's happening here?
The United States has about 5,000, probably a bit more, in Iraq. The mission is to counter ISIS, and that mission has been largely successful. But Iran's influence has been growing on the ground for a very long time, and it also played an important role in countering ISIS. It had militia allies trained and aided by Iran under the Popular Mobilization Forces, more than 60 different militias in Iraq that formed together as ISIS pushed deeper into Iraq, seized a third of the country. They mobilized under the Popular Mobilization Forces that the Iraqi government, because its own army had fallen apart, an army trained by the United States, recognized as an official branch of the Iraqi military. And so that's where the conundrum is. You know, what do you do about a militia that is part now of the Iraqi government, which the Iraqi government has not fully controlled and that sometimes reflects Iran's interests more than Iraq's?
Turning to Iran for a second here, back in the summer, as you mentioned, U.S. tensions with Iran had escalated dramatically. After Iran shot down a U.S. drone, the White House increased sanctions. We know that the Iran nuclear deal continues to unravel. And at the same time, in early December, the U.S. and Iran engaged in a prisoner swap. So I'm wondering, what is the relationship with these two countries following this most recent airstrike in Iraq?
An even more important question after what's happened in the last week. It's very interesting that both sides are trying to ratchet up the pressure. In the United States case, to push Iran back to the negotiating table and to give more than it did in the 2015 nuclear deal. Iran is ratcheting up the pressure because it wants to force the United States to give it a reprieve from very tough economic sanctions. Both sides, at the end of the day, still want diplomacy. It's just very hard to see how they get there.
President Trump is known for, or at least says, that he's not interested in meddling much in the Middle East. And his troop withdrawal from Syria, I think, was one of the biggest examples of that. Is this forcing the president, Robin, to engage in an area that he has previously said that he is not interested in doing?
Indeed, it has. And remember when he said he was going to withdraw just over a year ago from Syria, he ended up keeping most of those troops there. President Trump is learning the hard lesson that every one of his predecessors has learned. The Middle East can just suck you in, and events on the ground often, even always, overtake diplomacy. And it's very hard to resist when you're under attack, not sending in more troops. The question is, do you withdraw completely? And if you do, do you leave an embassy or your diplomats much more vulnerable? It's a question we also face in Afghanistan.
Well, speaking of that invasion in Afghanistan, peace talks between the U.S. and the Taliban have been announced and then canceled and then revived once again. What is the Trump administration's strategy in Afghanistan, if we're even able to say that there is a strategy?
Well, the United States wants to broker a ceasefire with the Taliban. That's not a peace deal. It's just a ceasefire to figure out a peace deal that would probably bring the Taliban into the government in some prominent role. And you're absolutely right. The peace talks have started and stopped and started and stopped, again, largely because of attacks that the Taliban continues to carry out. This is a very volatile environment, and the president, in an election year, wants to follow through on what he promised when he became president, and that was to withdraw American troops from foreign war zones, and he's finding it very difficult to achieve.
Robin, pivoting for a moment from the situation in the Middle East, there are a couple of other areas that the president is going to have to really take a look at. North Korea. Kim Jong-un indicated that his country, however, is planning to begin new tests of missiles and nuclear weapons. What does that tell us about the Trump administration's policy with regard to North Korea?
Well, North Korea was President Trump's boldest diplomatic initiative, and he did something that no other president has been willing to do, to sit down with Kim Jong-un, one of the world's most brutal dictators. Trump at one point said they'd fallen in love with each other, and they agreed initially to denuclearize. The problem is North Korea has done nothing in terms of even defining what it sees as denuclearization and what it wants from the U.S. in exchange. Kim imposed a December 31st deadline for the moratorium on testing some of his deadliest weapons. That deadline is passed, and he has now announced that North Korea has a new strategic weapon that he intends to unveil to the world. We're not sure what that is, but it could cover a lot of different things. It's very hard to see how the diplomatic process gets started again. There's been no tangible progress on Trump's boldest initiative, and all of the leaders around the world who want something from the United States recognize that President Trump is vulnerable.
To that end, we've seen two trends, I would say, globally at least. 2019, you've written about this and we've talked about this on The Takeaway, was a year of protests around the world. At the same time, we've seen that there have been more nationalistic right-wing, ultra-right-wing movements. What does that tell us, Robin, about what that could mean for U.S. foreign policy?
Well, President Trump actually likes many of the right-wing leaders or the tough guys. That's true not just in Latin America or Europe, but you look at Duterte, the president of the Philippines, Erdogan in Turkey, former field marshal, now President El-Sisi in Egypt. That is not something that President Trump fears, even if it devalues the progress in democracy around the world. But it is true that there is this kind of yin and yang of politics globally, where you see both the rise of right-wing leaders elected and also the outpouring of street protests. There is greater civil resistance around the world in a wide variety of ways, over a wide variety of issues, than at any time in human history. 2019 was really a turning point. Six countries in Latin America, several in Africa, across Europe. You saw even in France the Yellow Vest movement. Russia, Vladimir Putin faced his own protests. South Korea, considered a very stable place. Singapore, in very unlikely places, you've seen this outpouring from Prague to Port-au-Prince, Santiago, Harare. It just this array of protests that often began over very small issues, the attacks on WhatsApp calls in Lebanon, a 4-cent price increase in a liter of gas in Tehran, the price of onions in India. There is this real turmoil over the relationship between the individual and his state or her state. And I think this is going to be a pattern that will play out in 2020 because it's unclear how governments can respond and how these challenges may escalate in other ways.
Robin Wright is a distinguished fellow at the Wilson Center and a contributor to The New Yorker. Robin, thanks so much.
And Happy New Year to you.
And Happy New Year, and we made it.
and let's hope even more that we make it through the next one.
That is exactly. That's the small goals, baby steps here.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.